Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with a whole bunch of people, all representing the power of the Food Book Fair.
Woo-hoo.
But first and foremost, Elizabeth Thacker-Jones,
Hi.
The woman behind the fest itself. Thank you again. 2013 is upon us, a couple days away.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
And it only makes sense to kind of start this year with a little bit of coffee, an eye-opener. And we have two amazing guests with us today. Lars Hughes. I tried to do the inflection a little bit.
Yeah.
And Oliver Strand, who, awesomely enough, are leading a coffee crawl. When is that? On Friday from 2 to 4?
Yeah, on Friday afternoon.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'm going to let Elizabeth kind of take the mic and maybe even ask some questions here, too, as to, you know, why coffee crawl, why is that so important, and how does it connect into the larger scope of the Food Book Fair?
Sure. Well, the coffee crawl itself developed in a sort of organic sense in that, someone mentioned it to me as an idea. And it's not something I think that we think, you know, oh, what are we going to do today? We're going to go try like 20 different kinds of coffee.
Yeah.
Whereas you have like the beer crawl and you have pizza crawls and probably some other really unique crawls out there that we're only bound to find out about soon enough. But I think there's this interest in coffee, especially in sort of urban centers. And there's a developing urban center in Williamsburg with really, really good high quality coffee in a small area. So Charlotte Druckman actually mentioned the idea of the coffee crawl and how Oliver Strand has to do a coffee crawl at the Food Book Fair. She was very adamant.
Yeah, she's kind of a connector. She's
yeah.
very good at that.
Yes, yeah. yes. And I, you know, this is something I really want to actually credit her for having this idea because she planted the seed and I wrote to Oliver, just sort of Googled his email, I think, and didn't hear back and thought, well, that was a silly idea. There are so many crawls out there. We don't need another crawl. And then Oliver then I think wrote to me and said, Charlotte mentioned this thing. And, is this Elizabeth of the Food Book Fair? And then I don't know, 800 emails later.
We came up with a plan. Yeah.
yeah.
When Charlotte told me what to do, I just do it. You know, she said, you should get in touch and throw this. I will defend the coffee nerds out there. Like, it could be that beer crawls are a little more, have a little more traction in the world. But if you're a coffee kid, you do a coffee crawl when you show up in a town is what you do. So it's like you go to London and you hit as many places as your body can handle.
Yes.
And it's just kind of a coffee thing. Or like when you're in Oslo, you go to all the coffee spots, which is like six.
You do that one day, though.
Yeah.
yeah, you could do it on one day, you know, with one tram line.
Well, let's give you guys some accreditation here, too, because Oliver, I read your, you know, section in New York Times, Ristretto, for a long, long time. And I myself am not a coffee drinker, and that actually woke me up. It just was so engaging and enlightening for this burgeoning scene. And then Lars is all the way here from Oslo, from Norway, and writes and illustrates the wonderful blog. What is it? Illustration and Coffee.
Illustration and Coffee, yeah.
And But why? I mean, why this single subject for the both of you? What is the fascination, and how is there so much information to convey?
Gosh, coffee kind of chose me. I write about food, and I've been writing about food for a while, and coffee was one of the many topics I wrote about. And it just moved the needles in a way that no other topic ever has. People were so engaged after my first article came out. And I was really interested to see that. And I was interested to see two things. One, people don't know a lot about coffee. There's probably the widest gap between what's going on in the industry and what the public's understanding of that industry is. You know, of all of the gustatory pursuits. So you don't have to know a lot about wine to say, like, you know, I'm into this wine and it's aged in steel tanks, or it's a natural wine. You can kind of understand that, but you can know a lot about coffee. You can drink coffee every day, and I could say, yeah, actually, that's not a natural process. It's a pulp natural. You have no idea what I'm talking about. So what's going on in the industry is really sophisticated, and what's going on in the public, the understanding that the public has, is actually pretty unsophisticated. So when I wrote this article, I was shocked to see how many people wanted to know more about this topic. They didn't realize that it was that deep, and they actually wanted to know more. And as a writer, you can't ask for anything more. Like, you want to be able to geek out and have everybody stay with you every step of the way. And in coffee, it's just like the story hasn't really been told yet.
Yeah, or seen, for that matter, too, because knowing about those processes, and this is where Lars comes into play, too.
Yeah.
You know, even though it seems like that very dramatic sense of an illustrator sitting in a coffee shop doodling away, you were doodling about what you were sitting in.
Yeah, but never with coffee.
It's more of a tea guy.
It's the theme, not the medium.
Yeah,
right.
Well, right. I mean, you can fuse those two things together someday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's I think for me, I try to, you know, a lot, basically the same that Oliver is doing, but only visually. Like, I try to make specialty coffee a bit more accessible for, you know, the common person, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, let's take those two words, specialty and common, because there are these things that common coffee drinkers don't know about, mm-hmm. as you were stressing before. What are some of those things? Is it a process? Is it a kind of coffee?
I think what's the most interesting, or for me what's most important, is that we look at perceptions and, you know, what is coffee? That's it seems like there's, you know, an established sort of terminology in terms of thinking about coffee, which is, you know, something comfortable, hot, black, brown, whatever, in a cup. And coffee is so much more than that, and it's evolved so much. It's constantly developing, which is, that's what's really exciting. And I think that's really why, you know, we are into coffee and combining it in that sort of way.
Yeah.
Well, like, as arbiters of, you know, this subject, how would you help develop somebody's palate or understanding?
Well, at the risk of sounding too reductionist, I want for people to drink coffee because of how it tastes. And that's actually, you might not realize it, but very few people do that. By that, I mean, like, you go into a restaurant, like, we just had a couple of pizzas here. We had three pizzas. So if you want to go and look at it, we tasted three pizzas against each other. Most people don't wake up in the morning and have three coffees against each other. They'll have that one coffee. They might have a second version of that same coffee. If they go out to a shop, they might do the same thing. They've got their one order. So when you're tasting coffee at home, and then you go to a shop one day and you go to a different shop a third day, what you're relying on is taste memory. You're not actually tasting anything against another thing. When you have a meal, a normal meal, you're tasting three things, eight things, 12 things, 20 things, if it's an elaborate meal. If you're drinking, you know, you might have two or three beers against each other. You might have four or five different wines against each other. It's mind-blowing the first time you actually taste coffee for how it tastes, not to wake you up and not to remind you of a flavor that you had the day before, a flavor that you want. Like, if you go out to get that cappuccino that you had last week, that's how most people go out to have a coffee, but they don't get a blended espresso versus a single origin espresso and then go to the shop down the street to see what their blended espresso is like. So that's what you do in the crawl. I mean, it's as basic as that. I want for people to drink coffee for how it tastes and to taste different coffee, because then you really learn how it tastes. most people don't do that. In the industry, you do it all the time.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that. What is a cupping, and what, you know, how do you go through tasting coffee in that sense?
Well, yeah, so on the crawl, we're going to start off with a cupping, and it is a industry standard way to judge a coffee. So it's a very neutral way to prepare a coffee. And basically, you grind some beans, you put them in a little shallow bowl, you put in hot water, you smell the grounds, and then you put in hot water, and then you smell that, and then you crack the little crust off the top, and you smell that, and then you wait a little bit until it cools, and then you put kind of a flat soup spoon in there, and you slurp the coffee in the back of your throat.
Oh, we're going to do an impromptu cupping? Thought you had, like, some fold-out cupping.
This coffee shop.
Well, and there's... there we go. So, yeah, so everybody at home, if you can see this spoon, it's kind of flat.
Visualize a spoon.
Oh, here, and I'm going to go and make a cupping sound. I'm an okay cupper, but a lot of it is to make the noise.
Have competition.
You can do it right.
Oh, so it's gonna, cupping sound.
It's pretty good, right? Here. Yeah. Here, you can do it.
I'm doing
it. I can't tell whether or not it's the Norwegian or just... Oh,
there
that's
we
much
go.
Better.
There we go. And then there are people who whistle. So I have all kinds of audio of these cuppings where you just have this kind of pretty aggressive, kind of nasty sound, and it's all around you. But the idea is the preparation is neutral, so it's not going through a machine, it's not a Chemex, it's not anything like that. It's basically cowboy coffee. And what you want to do is just kind of taste the coffee. So if you taste that, then you're really tasting that coffee naked.
But what you get with the cupping as well, when you're slurping it, is those retronasal aromas where you actually get all of, you know... I don't want to get too deep into how your palate works and taste and all that, but, you know, most tastes are actually aromas. And, you know, you could, if you just slurp your regular, you know, regular coffee and, you know,
Just no kind of make
thing.
A sound when you drink your coffee and throw it in the back of your throat, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So with the cupping, that's kind of the industry standard way to go and taste coffee. Usually, when you're in a company like a roaster, then you're tasting your own coffees, and you're in a competition, you're tasting one roaster's coffees against another roaster's coffees, or one grower's coffees against another grower's coffees. And when you have that experience, especially a big cupping, you might have 20 coffees, 50 coffees, it's not unusual. You might have a series of those. Over the course of the day, you might taste 100, 120, 150 coffees. It's very clear what's good and what's bad. If you're just a consumer and you go to that shop around the corner, you don't necessarily know... You don't know what they're doing right, and you don't know what they're doing wrong. You really have to triangulate that with other places. So the idea of the crawl is to kind of let these people figure out, hey, you know, I like this. I like what they're doing over here. I'm not that crazy about that. Or I never thought about what this other place is doing, and I kind of like that.
See, you know what I find fascinating about coffee right now? You know, Lars is coming in from Norway, and you're going to go on this journey cupping around Brooklyn. But... the place where the beans are, you know, cultivated.
Origin.
Yeah, the origins aren't really coffee shop locales.
Well,
it's just beginning to maybe kind of change a little bit.
What you can see, which is quite interesting, is with a recent World Barista Champions. From the last two ones have been from growing nations.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So
Guatemala.
It was Guatemala and... Colombia before that.
Yeah. And then like in Brazil, which is the number one producer of coffee in the world, it's also a growing economy. So they're starting to consume good stuff there, and there are coffee shops in Sao Paulo that are fantastic. You know, coffee is a cash crop. It's a way for a country to get currency into the country. So you always export your best stuff. You always do that. You know, so if you're getting coffee in Kenya, which grows some of the most beautiful coffee in the world, if you're buying coffee in Kenya, like a cup of coffee, you're buying the worst of their crop because it's so much more important to the country to make money on the good stuff and get it out. So it's starting to change in Latin America as they're looking to hold on to their best stuff. That's incremental. But, you know, coffee is a colonial crop. It was taken around the world by European powers to their colonies as a way to, you know, make money. That's the history and that's the heritage of it. And that it's starting to change now is actually extraordinary because this is the first time since really Ethiopia and Yemen that the countries that grow coffee are consuming it also.
Can you give us a little sampling of this tour of who we might actually see?
Yeah, well, I was wondering, as Oliver was talking about his book, actually, if you could.
Oh, yeah, it is the Food Book Fair.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a book in progress. So the food manuscript fair, right?
Yeah.
The food typescript fair.
Some, as you know, it is a place to...
Yeah, some are in progress.
Percolating, per se.
deals will happen.
Yeah, yeah, that's exciting for people. Yeah, so I'm writing a book. It's going to be published by HarperCollins. I don't have a publication date. I am working on the manuscript. And I'm looking at coffee all around the world. So I spent some time in Norway, which is where I met Lars. He was a barista at the time, a fantastic coffee shop there. And Oslo has this reputation for having really good coffee, but it's also very polarizing. There are some people who think that, you know, it's actually not that special, and other people who think it's really quite special. And I went there to judge for myself, and it was unbelievable. The coffee in Oslo is unbelievable. It's not quite like anybody else's out there in the world. And Lars has brought back coffee from two roasters.
Wait, you got some.
I've got one too. Yeah. So I
which roasters?
Kaffa, which is extraordinary, and then Solberg and Hansen, which is this heritage roaster from the 1800s that has kind of reinvented itself and it's doing beautiful work. And then I have some coffees from Tim Wendelboe. So, you know, not to play like the best in the world game, because that's not a fun game to play. These are all extraordinary, and as to which one is kind of, you know, ahead of the pack, it's like what's going on that week and that day. They're all so talented, and they're all buying such beautiful ingredients and such beautiful product and handling it so well. It's going to be amazing. So we're going to end with that. We're going to end with a bunch of coffees from Kaffa, Tim Wendelboe, and Solberg and Hansen, which is just, you know, like, it's bringing out the all-star team to go and kick around a ball.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you can still get tickets online, right?
Yeah, there are a couple tickets left.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to ask Lars again, too, coming from this place that has, you know, that amazing trifecta of beans, just, yeah. What are you excited about in Brooklyn, specifically?
It's been 2 years since I was last in New York City, so I'm just really looking forward to, you know, check out everything.
Yeah.
So many, you know, that's what I love about the city as well. It's like the coffee scene is always changing, and that's something I really love about London as well, which is, you know, it's been sort of my residence the past couple of years. But yes, I love diversity.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, let's talk about, you know, even techniques or, you know, new terminology, like flat white has only hit the Brooklyn right. scene in the past
flat
year
what
or
is,
two.
What is a flat white? That's, you know, that... it makes me a little bit upset. I don't know. It's such a loose definition. It could be anything. And
it's a cappuccino. It's a latte or
it's yeah, Java latte. You know.
Yeah.
There are two terms for cortados as well, right?
Well, there's
one thing.
Yeah, there's a cortado, and then there's a Gibraltar, which was kind of birthed through Blue Bottle, you know, mm-hmm. and the both of those are a riff off of the cortado in Spain, but the milk is a little more steam. It's a little more, as they say, textured. There's a technical term. You don't steam milk; you texture milk.
Mm-hmm. That's a coffee drink, though. Like,
what's that?
With cortados and, you know, flat whites, whatever. It's you're adding coffees, you know, the baseline ingredient, and then you're adding milk to make it into a drink. But then I think what is more interesting, especially for me, is the actual coffee, like when you're cupping it, for instance, or you know, having a filter coffee, you're just tasting the coffee and what's, you know, inherent in that, and that's the result of the process. And
well, this is interesting, you know, because like outside of the industry, everybody's kind of into espresso drinks. That's kind of, you know, you've got the equipment, there's a boiler, it's all really involved and expensive and sexy. Within coffee, espresso's fine. Like, a good espresso's nice. A good cappuccino is indulged in the way you would, like, have a stack of pancakes and bacon. You know, it's a thing you do every once in a while. It's not a thing you do every day if you're in coffee. They're obsessed with filter coffee because it's a much more pure expression, and they want to taste that. So I think that's interesting. Like, the public is into lattes and cappuccinos, but if you were to go to a person in the industry, they're going to ask for a filter coffee, a drip coffee, you know, an AeroPress or something like that.
You know, because I from Lars's point of view, too, it's the illustrative points, the things that you can see. And it seems like such a almost boring baseline thing to, you know, show the differences between that baseline coffee. How, as an illustrator, do you, you know, show that diversity?
Specificity. I got to specify and really, you know, be accurate with things. It's not just random. It's not just it's something very specific that happens as part of a very, very, very demanding process, and it's very complex. We don't really understand all of it yet either. So how can I help build on that and kind of reform the I guess, the aesthetic for specialty coffee, make it more direct, and, you know, just really following people like Tim Wendelbo when he's really working with the producers to help them make better coffee. You know, you don't really see that in a lot of coffee-related stuff.
Yeah, well, when you say the industry, that's like the third wave industry, which is much smaller than the capital I industry.
Yeah, but the third wave, so the industry term is specialty coffee. That's what it's actually called, and that's a term that was kind of introduced in, I think, the 80s. I should know that date, actually. So specialty coffee is bigger than you'd think. Specialty coffee in the U.S. is like a $15 billion industry, between $12 and $15 billion. So that's the upscale stuff. That's not the can of coffee in the supermarket. You know, so it's...
Is that Starbucks as well?
It does include Starbucks, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's bigger than Hollywood. You know, Hollywood's like an $8 billion industry. So people are spending more money on snobby coffee than they are Hollywood, although I guess, you know, Hollywood is kind of a punching bag right now. It's not like it's it's doing that well. But it's surprising how many people are participating in this and how many people are curious. And it's still kind of treated like a fringe thing or a niche thing when it's actually just this enormous, enormous marketplace.
Well, I mean, once you publish your book, they'll just have to adapt it into Coffee the Movie.
Yeah.
Coffee
the Movie.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then actually come back for a little lunch, dinner, session of the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
You know, HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Hey, and welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a special edition of the Food Book Fair 2013, Elizabeth Thacker-Jones, the founder here. And the next session we'll move into, actually, this is perfect for my show, The Intersections of Food and Art, is Amelia Martin, chef owner, The Smile.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
First of all, I don't know why I am enamored by any place that you have to walk down the stairs to, but I am. So you won me at that on the onset. But you come from a very interesting background of art collectors themselves. Can you tell me what you were surrounded by as a youth?
Well, both of my parents are painters, and my sister became an art dealer, so she opened a gallery right out of college, and I sort of around that.
That was Rivington Arms, right?
Yes.
Oh, I used to love that place.
Yes, me too.
It's no longer.
No, she closed it maybe 3 years ago, so it's a memory now.
A fond,
very
memory.
Fond memory, a formative memory.
But what kind of art? Was it all 2D? Was it sculptural? Was it photographs?
That she showed or that I grew up
that
around?
That you grew up around.
Well, I mean, you know, a mix. I mean, my parents were painters, abstract painters, so that was like a big part of my life. But, you know, all their friends were different kinds of artists. It was just a very natural thing.
And then growing up in the West Village, too, obviously you were surrounded by that art, but there was also a good food scene there.
Yes. I feel like when you're growing up, you don't notice how lucky you are to be around good food until, you know, later you realize other people didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know.
But what did you grow up eating and engaging yourself with?
Well, my mom was an amazing cook, and she was really into traveling. She would make like Moroccan food and a lot of Greek food, Thai food. So she was really a big influence for me. Now, I guess.
Yeah, you know what I also found interesting is, you know, you constantly were at the edge of figuring out what you wanted to do. Was it art? Was it food? And when did that amalgamation happen? You went to school for design. You interned at a magazine.
Yeah, I studied art history in college, and it was. I think, you know, a lot of people now are figuring out what they want to do a little bit later than used to be the norm. And I guess I was just always surrounded by the art world and kind of fell into that thing naturally. But I didn't really want to be an artist. So I didn't really want to do anything like that.
Can you draw? Can you illustrate?
No. I mean, I used to. Yeah. I used to draw growing up. But yeah. No.
So, sorry to mention her name if you find it off-putting, but Rachel Ray.
I actually like Rachel Ray.
Me too. And I really would love her on the station, on the show, because I think she's kind of curated herself and what she does in such a, you know, obviously huge way now, but really smart way as well. What did you learn from being there about both food and design and art and magazine?
Well, yeah, I worked at her magazine. I was an intern, like a very lowly intern when it first launched. And I think she is amazing. I think she is like the person who's bringing maybe this wave of like food awareness to the most people. Like, because she's very approachable. She's very palatable for like so many people. Like when I was there, I would read the fan mail that came for her, and it was overwhelming and also like really touching that people just relate to the way she cooks. And I think she's teaching people to cook in a healthier way.
Yeah. No, agreed. And, you know, looking at the smile now, jumping ahead to where you are right now, how do you take some of those ideas that Rachel Ray had and pour those into your workplace?
I could never be Rachel Ray. I mean, I try and make things as simple as they can be and be the best they can be. I think in like developing recipes for the restaurant or for my cookbook, you want something to be, you know, the least amount of elements, or I want something to be the least amount of elements and still be delicious and work in the most like elemental way.
I'm going to interject here. Please. Too, that Melia worked closely with Jennifer Rubel, who I think maybe her work is a little bit more emblematic of what you're doing now, and that it's very subtle, that there's, you know, purpose and there's art influence in what you're doing, but I feel like your book Modern Mediterranean sort of took a leap to say like this is the kind of cuisine that you are most comfortable in perhaps, but that up until this point the smile has been more about, you know, just being seasonal, being fresh, being beautiful on the plate. Would you say that's true?
Yes. I mean, I think the smile, unlike some places that are completely like seasonal or completely driven by experimenting with like market fresh food, which we do, but I also really want it to be like a neighborhood staple, you know, where you can go and get that thing that you love to have, like, you know, once a week, or, you know, get the roast chicken that you just crave. So hopefully hopefully people are feeling that way about the restaurant. And for the book, I think it's the same thing. I want it to be like, you know, things that are easy that anyone can do and that just feel like part of your like standard recipe fallback.
Is Mediterranean part of your life? Did you grow up, you know, with lineage there, visiting there?
I did. My family has had a house in Greece since the 70s because my mom loved to travel, and she went to this tiny island there, and it was just really small, and she fell in love with it, and then she kept going back, and she ended up getting a house there. So I was lucky enough to grow up going to this place every summer and just having this really simple Greek island cooking as like a backbone of my
What are those palette. Ingredients? They really floral, oregano, feta cheeses.
Oregano, definitely a lot of dried oregano, but really great tomatoes, you know, cucumbers, fresh fish, grilled fish, lemons, just like very simple, clean flavors.
Yeah, I mean, I know there are Greek kind of enclaves in New York and Astoria. Why hasn't been as prevalent as it, you know, I think it should be here in New York?
I think Greek food is one of those things that it's hard to do, like, the fancy version of Greek food. I think people try, and there are some good places like that, but it never gets elevated to that, like, fine dining thing. But I love the food in Astoria. My husband's actually from Astoria, so it's come full circle that I go there all the time, and it's, like, my New York.
Can I give a quick shout-out to your husband? Because yeah. I actually do watch or have watched all his programming along the way.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a big supporter of Kid America.
Oh, cool. Yes, excellent. Kid America.
Yeah.
I don't call him that at home.
No. Just Kid, for short.
Yeah.
But the modern aspect of Mediterranean, how are you modernizing, you know, old Mediterranean cookbooks?
Well, I had wanted to call it Manhattan Mediterranean at first, because to me it's like my New York version of Mediterranean cooking. So we're like, you know, New York local seasonal ingredients. But the modern version is really just like sort of how I have filtered the different Mediterranean food I've had. So it's not like, you know, classic hardcore Greek specialty cooking. So if that's what you want, it's not that. It's more like one woman's version of cooking with those flavors.
Yeah. You know, going back to Jennifer Rubel, which Elizabeth obviously knows.
Well, both of us worked for Jennifer.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were both.
But, I mean, talking about simple, straightforward, Jennifer as well, emblematic or iconic things. Like, you define something as a flavor or as, you know, some kind of key to the rest of whatever project you are doing. Do you feel like your food is similar in that fashion? You know, tomato, oregano, olive oil.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely stole a lot of good ideas from Jennifer. It's good that I worked
for
her.
We all did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you start with like a very basic thing that you're attracted to, like a certain kind of like really bright lemon flavor, and then you go from there. But there's just usually one thing that's simple that drives a recipe.
So, I mean, aside from building a menu through those flavor profiles, how do you build a book like that?
Well, the fun thing about a book, which I'm sure you know, is that it's really visual, and I got to like finally work with something that was that I've always loved, like a really aesthetic representation of what I do. And I think that's always important in a restaurant, your presentation or at home, just like the colors and the dishes that you use and everything. So it was like I could bring all that to some like finite object that I could share with the world.
Let's talk about that art direction. I mean, what was the flair? I have never been to Greece, but I feel like I've been transported by going into Greek restaurants and seeing the tile or, you know, certain patterns.
Yeah, well, I used a lot of old photos of growing up summers in Greece, but then the actual presentation of the food is less like Greek restaurant, you know, bougainvillea and, I don't know, like blue and white. More just stuff that I collect at home. I do a lot of collecting of antiques and like weird little ephemera and I don't know, kind of more poppy stuff. So I worked that into the book.
Yeah. You know, Malia is part of the Thursday tasting, you know, opening
yeah.
party for the Food
the
Book
opening
Fair,
night.
Which I am super psyched about. And it feels like a lot of people on that list are of a similar vein, you know, reinterpretation or reintroduction of something. Can you tell me who else was
sure.
on that list?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nancy Hashisu, her book is called Japanese Farm Food. And I would say she definitely falls into that category. A woman named Ellen Zakos, whose book is called Backyard Foraging. Lauren Chun, who wrote the Kimchi Cookbook. And who else?
Matthew Weingarten?
Yes, Matthew Weingarten, who co-authored the Preserved Wild Foods with Raquel Pizzell.
So it's going to be fascinating. What are you making for that Thursday night?
I'm actually making a beet and watermelon radish salad with mozzarella and basil and like a citrus dressing.
It's awesome.
Which sounds so good. Yeah, and it's really funny because I ran into Melia at the Cherry Bomb party maybe 2 weeks ago, and we were chatting about her recipe, and I said, you know, your recipe sounds really good. I'm so excited. But, you know, watermelon isn't actually in season. Where are you going to get your watermelon?
She was just being polite. She thought it sounded terrible. Why are you making beet and watermelon? But it's actually watermelon radish.
Watermelon radish. Gotcha. Which
just a beautiful radish. Watermelon.
One of my interns read it as, because it was handwritten.
Right. I thought you were going to fight back and be like, watermelon's fresh somewhere. It's like, you know, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. Barrel clock somewhere.
No. I'm saving that for the summer.
So, gotcha. You know, this new breed of cookbooks from, you know, a younger generation that's modernizing something old. What do you look back to? What other cookbooks? What other, you know, information do you draw from?
Well, I have a couple favorite cookbooks. I think Paula Wolfert is like the standard Moroccan cookbook that I grew up with. My mom actually took classes with her, I think, in the 80s, and that was like the basis for all my, you know, family dinners growing up. So I always had that, and that's like a really, you know, like an interpretation of Moroccan cooking that's very classic. And I also really like Diana Henry. She has a book called Crazy Water Pickled Lemons that has been like a big inspiration for me. And
I love the visual aspect of that book. That the photographer is Jason Lowe, and he used reciprocity failure. That's photo geeky stuff, but it is. It's kind of an amazing book because it showed, again, something so simple in like a completely different aesthetic light on top of that.
It's almost like food journalism, that cookbook, because she really like traveled around like different, I mean, it's like Moroccan, Middle Eastern, I don't know, Israeli a bit. And I think it's like has that reporter's eye for food.
So what are you hoping to do with this book? Are you trying to make people come to the Smile, go to Greece, both?
Both. I don't know. I just want people to, like, enjoy it at home, just to have these recipes become part of their daily life. Just the way I took from Diana Henry's book, and there's things that are, like, just part of my life now that I love. I hope that someone does that with this book. And comes to the Smile.
Yeah.
Tries it there, too.
Certainly. You know, it's funny. Christoph, who's going to be on next, he and I were talking on the train ride over about, you know, how do you separate or how do you combine a restaurant book versus a personal book? And sometimes, you know, the restaurant book is personal, and people will cook it at home and then come to the restaurant to see how they did. How did you do that, you know, growing up, cooking from cookbooks? Did you cook recipes and then go to restaurants, or did you have any kind of contrast compare?
Yeah, well, I think restaurant cookbooks, a lot of times they can be really difficult because the way you cook in a restaurant is not the way you cook at home. You don't have, like, prep cooks. You don't prep in the same way. So a restaurant cookbook can really be something that you just use, like, sparingly to remind you of the dish that you like at the restaurant. But I think the food at the Smile is more like home-cooked food. Or that's what I've tried to do. So it was very natural to do the cookbook for home cooks because it doesn't have that like super plated, super layered restaurant feel to it. It's almost a more natural fit for the home cook than a restaurant.
So when did you guys cross over when you worked for Jennifer?
It's funny because we were both her assistant. So I would come to find like a file with Melia's name on it.
I was like the ghost in the office from before.
Yeah. And finally I asked, like, who's Melia? And then we went to lunch at the Smile.
Gotcha.
And met Melia.
But I mean, so let's talk about eating with Jennifer. What kind of meals would you have? Would it be these big constructed things or these very simple home style?
she would make these amazing simple lunches for me when I was there, because she would just take whatever was in the fridge, or we'd been testing recipes for Domino, where she used to write for, and she would make like a really simple salad with like something amazing drizzled on top. And it was very simple but perfect.
Yes. Fully sort of, I mean, her like olive oils, like she'd always have like three or four that she sort of meticulously like cycle depending on what she was making. And she had like, she has, you know, a real sort of passion for things like salt and honey and vinegar, like just really the basics. And her refrigerator is always like completely immaculate. Everything has its place.
Not like my refrigerator. Yeah, my refrigerator has like 10 jars of olives and everything's rotting. And
yeah, salsa jars.
But you know, I keep on coming back to this idea of, you say meticulous, but I think curated. And such simple, basic things like olive oil, salt, honey, they come from a trusted person or a trusted network. And, you know, it takes years to get to that point. It's not like you're going to walk into a specialty shop and be able to pick the best, you know, most wonderful thing the first time you pick it out. So you learn from these life experiences, and it may seem simple, but it's taken years of, you know, process of elimination almost in my mind.
That's the fun part about cooking, that you get to try 10 different olive oils over the course of however many years and find out what you love.
I think, and which are your favorite basics, your staples right now?
Which brands?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I actually, one of the cooks at This Mile, his family has an olive oil farm. I guess they do olives as well. And he just brought me some recently that they don't sell here. And it was like the most amazing thing I've ever tasted. So it completely changed the way I think about olive oil.
Yeah.
So there's always something new out there.
Yeah. And yeah, it's not a stunted community at all. I mean, we just heard about coffee and how expansive and how much we don't know. And, you know, yeah, with everything, with each cuisine, with each basic ingredient, it's that same way. So I'm excited to see your book, eat your food, and get this food book fair on the road. Anything to add, Elizabeth?
I don't think so. I think you'll have to see what happens on Thursday.
Excellent. I'm excited.
More to come.
More to come. We're going to take another quick break and then talk to Christoph Ille. Ille? Manila.
Hilla. Hilla. Rhymes with Manila.
That's it. I knew I wrote Manila on there.
Or and Thrilla.
I forgot about what it meant. And get a little fiery about food and labor.
Exactamundo.
So you've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Again, Food Book Fair Special 2013. Get your tickets now. A whole bunch of amazing events ranging from opening night, coffee crawl, and a fiery debate with Christoph.
Hello, everybody.
So, food and labor. The author Elizabeth, who is on that panel, is Saru, and you can pronounce her last name for me.
Jere Yaman.
Much better than I would have done. Is doing a book about an exploration, or wrote a book about an exploration, what's behind the kitchen doors and the labor industry, the disputes there with, you know, a living wage. Now, you own, operate Northern Spy Food Co. in the East Village.
Yes.
Which is an amazing, amazing place if you haven't gone and not blown smoke up your ass. See, I cursed. I've been trying to work it in some way. But, you know, obviously staffing a restaurant is something different than feeding your patrons. What is it like to be a manager, to have that kind of head in the industry?
It's an extraordinary challenge. It's it is the biggest challenge that we have day to day as a restaurant, and that I think probably any restaurant has. When you start, when you decide to get into the restaurant business, I don't know if you had the same experience, but you really think a lot of things about, you know, you spend a lot of time thinking about menus and food cost and location and rent. Rent is a really big one. Rent, you know, unless you make a terrible decision, ends up being not that big of a deal. What is a big deal day to day is labor. It's hiring people, trying to be, you know, more or less compliant with important human resources issues. Paying people on time, making payroll, it's far and away the biggest concern that you have. It occupies the most of your time. First of all, restaurant work is not like clerical work or office work, where if somebody doesn't show up in an office, most of the time the things that happen can be deferred or can be sort of spread out amongst people. And because of the workflow, you know, the organization of what an office does. The restaurant is like a little military operation. You know, the guy on like the gun, you got the guy on the wheel, you got the guy on like the back, you know, the navigator. If one person doesn't show up, it's much harder to make the ship move. And that is like that constant sort of one step away from crisis mode that a lot of restaurants live in. And as you get bigger, it ceases to be as big of a deal because, you know, if you have 10 prep cooks and one doesn't show up, it's not that big of a deal. We have one prep cook every day. If that guy, you know, bails on us or we don't treat him right or whatever it is, we are in a world of hurt.
So, Elizabeth, the majority of the books at the Food Book Fair, I would say, air towards food itself, air towards cooking, technique.
Culture side, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How important is a topic like this in the larger discussion of the fair?
Extremely important. I mean, I think the fair tries to live in that area where the culture side and the other side, the system side, the politics, the sociology, the history, where they all come together. So we have probably, you know, 50 plus actual books that are about these topics, in addition to several panels with participants that are talking about these topics, from the sort of new agrarian movement to food's relationship to design. This issue is something I feel personally very passionate about. My great grandfather was the first to have the 8-hour workday in his factory at the turn of the century, and it's sort of in my family's blood. My dad is named for him, and my brother is as well, and so is my younger brother. So the issue of labor is something that, when we are talking about food, it's not necessarily fun. It can be heavy. It can be it can sort of create a divide and an awkward pause in the room. So this is a panel that has actually been people are very excited about it, I think, because it's not always talked about in the same breath as, you know, here's this lovely cooking demo we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about lifestyle, because we just talked to Amelia about Mediterranean and projecting some kind of, you know, ambiance around food, around cooking. To be able to afford that in a restaurant, you know, to have people have wages and produce the kind of food that you're producing, is a completely different, you know, feeling. You're projecting something else. It must be a hard thing to maintain that and the quality of food at the same time.
It requires enlisting everybody really in the same mission, and you create systems to sort of protect yourself in case, you know, a couple of people aren't really on that mission. And that is, again, part of the staffing issue of you're constantly, you know, in the restaurant industry has extremely high turnover. I think people who work in offices and, you know, what we call regular jobs are, you know, are shocked, I think, at the turnover. I mean, you can have somebody for 6 months, 3 months, you know, maybe a year if you're lucky, before they move on. And that is, of course, partly related to the wage issue, but it's also, there is a naturally peripatetic tendency in cooks to want to explore, find new things, build their resume, you know, and go on to the next thing. So you're always sort of like in this mode of like, hey, guys, we all believe in this, right? Like, we're here together, right? We're doing something good. And, you know, most of the time it works and sometimes it doesn't. And you can tell, you know, in food media, like, you can tell when somebody is pointing out something that wasn't quite right in a restaurant, and you think, yeah, the guys were probably just not into it. You know, they were just, they're like, screw this. Yeah. I want to go home.
So, I mean, how do you foster a crew like that? Because, you know, it feels very, well, these days people are more prevalent to open up their own thing. You know, say, I'm going to be here for a year and then I'm going to do my own thing, rather than invest themselves in someone else's business.
Well, it's really expensive to do your own thing, and it's extraordinarily daunting, and I can attest that the returns are meager. So you do have them for a while in their life, and you offer the best that you can, you know, in lieu of extraordinary wages. You know, I think we have at our place a really decent work environment. We, you know, everybody gets paid overtime as they should. And, you know, you try and take care of people, like if they have issues, you know, like I bailed a guy out of jail once, you know, like I've done that sort of stuff. And, you know, that stuff happens. And it's the best you can do because you're all there 50 hours a week together. So they're family and your family. It's highly imperfect family. And you do what you can. I mean, in this panel, I'm excited to be part of it because I'm totally not a labor expert, but I've sort of fashioned myself into a little bit of one through research and just the experience for, you know, 3.5 years through Northern Spy and then, you know, previous experiences in San Francisco, you know, cutting a lot of checks for people, hiring a lot of people, firing a couple of people, dealing with human resources stuff on, you know, on the very much ground level. I think that there are two conversations that are going to happen, and hopefully we can merge them in this panel, which is that there's sort of like a progressive politics that is being sort of leveled at the food industry. And then there's sort of like the on the ground experience of like, okay, how do we actualize that? Because it's like everything else, it's very messy. And a lot of it has to do with really big stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not something you can institute when opening a restaurant. It's something that happens down the road once you...
How you mean, like really developing good sort of labor practices?
Yeah.
You can out of the gates if you're really, really sharp. I think as you get bigger, you know, you look like a Mark Murphy type operation. You know, Benchmark is this company, I think, right? Benchmark. I mean, they're so big now. He's like invested so much in this human resources structure that he actually consults, you know, advises people on it, and has developed such expertise that probably out of the gates, he does probably like 90% of things correctly. The rest of us are scrambling to figure out how to get Con Ed just to show up to turn on your damn gas so then you can get your health inspection so then you can open your doors because you're like eating it on rent every month that you're not open. And so really, human resources issues are like, you know, 5 steps behind that. Like you're just trying to open your doors and then, you know, you're trying to figure out how to like, you know, get enough cash flow that you can make payroll every week. And then by the time, you know, you move into it, you're so swamped with operations that, you know, a year goes by before you realize that, oh my God, I've been like doing this really illegal thing.
You won't say what that is on air.
No.
But, you know, it's interesting to see this conversation sandwich in between, you know, the coffee crawl and some other food things, that it is such a, you know, intertwined piece of restaurant, of food, of cookbooks. How many books kind of have both things going on at the same time?
Well, there are lots of books that will address issues that are not focused on this is how to cook or this is my food story or this is my, you know, memoir, but let's say are more about politics or diet, actually, and have recipes within. I would say a lot of the books that we have that are like Saru's book, or like Marion Nestle's book, or like Wendell Berry or Joel Salatin, are more sort of in academia, is really where they thrive. So, you know, they don't tend to have recipes, and you're sort of using food and food systems as a lens to talk about other topics. So there are lots of books. I mean, there are lots of books that we have to say, oh, you know, we're not going to carry that because, you know, it's like 4 or 5 years old. So we find there are more books coming out. I mean, every year, you know, within the next week, we have a book last week, Michael Pollan's latest book came out about cooking, but I don't believe it has recipes. And then, does it? It does have 4 recipes. Thank you, Oliver, fact checking. And then we have Mark Bittman's book coming out in a couple of days called Vegan Before 6, which is definitely recipe filled. But Mark Bittman, you know, he does sort of has one foot in both sort of worlds, in the systems world and in the, you know, straight up, this is how you cook world.
So, Christoph, we talked about, you know, maybe you someday doing a cookbook.
Yes.
Where does it sit? Or is there so much going on in your head about trying to put, you know, both the political, economic, you know, food, restaurant thing forwards that it seems ominous?
Like, where does it sit sort of in, like, what would that book look like? What would it smell like? All that sort of... I was thinking, I think it might be sort of like, oh, you know, oh, the mistakes I've made. it would be, you know, I think it would be sort of like a biography of a restaurant, I think, and where things stand now. We did so many things backwards and incorrectly, and we still scraped by and managed to make it. I mean, it's got a DIY element, the restaurant, that is both admirable and laughable at the same time, I think. And if I was ever to do it again, I would reduce the DIY and more DIT, I think, do it together. And so it'd be something like a biography of like how you get to this place. Like how does a place look like this after 3 years? Like, you know, who got us there? You know, it would definitely have like appendices in the back of like, don't do this, don't do that, incorrect procedure. You know, all these things. That would be very entertaining, I think, for... It would be sort of like... It would have, like, an insidery element where people could, like... Other restaurateurs could open it and say, ha!
Yeah. Again, it's the process of elimination idea. Right. Of, you know, having someone who is trusted, who's gone through that already, and not having to go through that
I think that's I think that would be a great niche in restaurant cookbooks, is sort of like, you know, have this element of, like, you know, sharing the things that we did wrong and the things that we wish we had chosen differently.
So let's talk about Journey, not the band, but, you know, these books that actually are about, you know, arriving somewhere or coming from someplace. Because I feel like the Food Book Fair really changed this year in that aspect, that it's not just about this book is out right now, but this book has come so far or meant so much to somebody, especially like Food and Conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's been actually a really interesting panel to put together, because in the last couple of months, you have the Gaza cookbook that came out. We were really hoping that they could come and participate, but they're traveling with their book. And then you have, you know, Joan Nathan on that panel, who is an incredible force. She's been also in both sides of that the conversation for a very long time, and a woman who's working on a cookbook about Cuban food, Ana Sofia Palaz, whose book will be coming out in a couple months. And we just added Sarah Jenkins, whose mother wrote the Gaza cookbook, who will be on that panel, and has a very interesting backstory. And I think that's a really good example of how we communicate through our love of food and through sort of connecting with cultures that are sometimes it's difficult to talk about them or, you know, through traveling, people experience a side of a place and develop a taste for a place through the lens of food. And I think you could, it's not just food that you're experiencing that necessarily, but we're writing more books about it. So it definitely means something.
So not to cut you off, Christoph, but the Food Book Fair, well, first of all, come see Christoph. He has so much more to say on this topic.
Sparks before.
Come see everybody who's been on the show. I mean, come support the Food Book Fair, because again, everything that we've discussed, from single subject to, you know, personal stories to labor disputes, they're all going to be there. It's not just, you know, that trailer that comes up to your school and you buy a book and you go home. There's interaction. There's a community there that really wants to talk about these policies, these systems, the future of food in so many different ways.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, look at Christoph's Twitter feed, for example. He's very active and well versed in that space, you know, putting out content in a different way. And we're really interested as a festival to explore all these different avenues, you know, as a platform, not just as 4 days in Williamsburg. So definitely come out. I want to say one more thing too that's interesting about Christoph's panel is Evelyn Kim is on the panel.
It's gonna be,
she is more than interesting. I don't even have the words to formulate what kind of energy she has.
Yeah, she has a lot of energy. She's actually coming from Copenhagen. She came last year as well. She happens to be working from there, but you wouldn't really know from her social media presence. She also recently wrote a piece about labor issues at the restaurant Noma, which has a lot of buzz around this restaurant for you know, its cuisine, for its book, for its celebrity chef, for its foraging and, you know, attention, but also attention to labor issues. They have really admirable and well-versed practices in that space. They provide health insurance for their employees. Evelyn wrote a piece that was basically in a response to Noma having an issue with a virus.
Norwalk virus outbreak,
yeah. Yeah, an outbreak that really, really brought them a lot of negative attention. And so that's sort of another aspect that we would like to.
Evelyn alone is worth the price of entry.
Right. Yeah. Yes, this is true. This is true.
So, I mean, aside from going to panels, listening to what people have to say, interacting with after, there are also interactive forums. You can go to Foodie Articles, which, again, like last year, is tons of dash articles.
Which I couldn't say that word for a year when we came up with it. And now I've just owned it.
Got it.
And then other people are using it in like other media outlets, which is really awesome because that's what it is.
There are dinners, one at Parish Hall, based on a book, My Side of the Mountain, which as a New Yorker growing up in this school system, I read many a times and should be absolutely awesome. But Food and Enterprise, can you tell me a little bit about that and how people can come? And
yeah, Food and Enterprise is Sunday, May 5th, and that we just went a little crazy wild. Like, okay, let's explore this entrepreneurship space. There are all these people making food and selling it in markets. There's, you know, a long history of local food in our food shed, you know, not just the green market that we have in Union Square, but, you know, 40 plus farmers markets and growing. So how do we sort of connect the dots between the producers and the entrepreneurs? We partnered with a nonprofit called Slow Money NYC, which is basically that's what their role is. They bring together investors and people who want to be able to bring high quality, local, sustainable food and resources into their businesses. And we have about 30 resources that we'll be essentially tabling for that whole day. from, you know, the usual suspects that are organizing CSAs, you know, Zipcar, that's a resource, and then you have, you know, a lot of consultancies, groups like IOBI, the Axion Group, a lot of, like, smaller groups that are funding projects even outside of the U.S. So it should be a really awesome day, and it's ending with a pitch competition. We have seven entrepreneurs working on projects that are, you know, either engaging with technology to build the local food infrastructure. We have a drink company, some other really interesting startup ideas that will, they'll all be presenting sort of Shark Tank style for 5 minutes. And then we have a group of judges who will then decide who gets the loot. The loot being some interesting like time with like an hour with an expert in their field, whether it be like someone who can help you write a business plan, a, you know, design strategist, someone at Good Food Jobs, like certain people like that. So you have a new network that you'll walk away with. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's more than pretty cool. And I don't know how you're just completely exhausted. So a big congratulations to you again for putting on the Food Book Fair. Go to foodbookfair.com. There are still tickets available. And two quick things. I'd like to say that we have two day passes to give away. Email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. First two to have free day pass. Food Book Fair in the, you know, subject line will get to come and experience whatever they want at the Food Book Fair. And Thursday night, the opening party is actually also a fundraiser for Veggie Island. A lot of us here remember Sandy, the superstorm, which was only about 6 months ago and still has, you know, gravely affected a lot of people out in Rockaway. And, you know, that's such a great thing that you're doing that for that organization and trying to get them, you know, up and running again. So yeah. I applaud that.
Thank you. They are, you know, they're running on a very small scale right now. PS1 built a dome out there, which has been like a community hub for all sorts of groups that are rebuilding that space, and then they'll open in their original space in the middle of May. But they still need a lot of electrical and plumbing work done in the next couple of weeks. So we're really glad that we're able to help them out.
Cool.
We've already raised $5,000 for them.
Awesome. So. Well, come see us all at the Food Book Fair. Lars, Oliver, Amelia, Christoph.
Yeah, come meet this motley crew.
Yeah, should
be
a blast.
It's gonna be a crazy
thing. And here's to 2014 as well.
Yeah.
Come support this event so it can happen again, again, and again until...
My prediction is that like in 2020, people are going to be saying, were you at Food Book Fair 2013?
Yeah. This is the one to be at, folks.
It's going to be that big.
Excellent. Wow. You've been listening to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We hope to have you back here next Thursday at 3. Come to the Food Book Fair.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.